Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
There's a lot of people I have to thank for getting this team to where we are today. But first and foremost, and probably the most important man, this man should be here instead of me receiving this cup today. His name is Cormac McGonagall.
Yes, the legendary words of Tyrone captain Brian Doerr as he lifted the Sam Maguire Cup in 2005. And of course, the man he was referring to there was the late Cormac McGonagall, who had died in 2004 and was very much been singled out as a future Tyrone senior football captain and one that would go on to win the All-Ireland. But he was taken tragically in 2004. His brother, Donal McGonagall, has written an amazing book about his brother Cormac called The Pursuit of Perfection, The Life, Death and Legacy of Cormac McGonagall. And Donal, I'm delighted to say you're in studio with us. You're very welcome.
Thank you, Dave.
And when you hear that now, I'm sure you've heard it so many times. What sort of feelings does it stir? What is it, 12 years on from Brian Doerr's speech?
I tell you what it stirs. It stirs the bit that I immediately think, I want to hear the bit that followed that.
Right.
Because what immediately followed that was a spontaneous chant from the crowd that was on the pitch, where they should be. Chanting Cormac, Cormac, Cormac. And, you know, nothing had prepared me mentally for that. And you know, I wanted it to go on and get louder and louder, but unfortunately Brian had to return to his speech as it was his duty, and then things, so I've had a really amazing high of knowing this was his team and that's where he would have been, and then things moved on, and that was, for me anyway, that was almost like a pivotal moment in the whole memorial process, because that was the act of completion of winning the title that he would have won and for him. And after that, just in an instant, things had moved on. Because after that, that was essentially still the same team, give or take one or two players in the panel, essentially his team. But after that, players would retire. It was Peter Cannon's last game, etc. The team changes, the team goes on its own journey. But that, even the way that, that moment when the speech moved on, for me...
Were you on the pitch?
No, I wasn't. Because I was close enough to the presentation, but not... I was in the Hogan stand, okay, and close enough, so I would have had to go down to the pitch. But also there's another dynamic, and that is Cormac wasn't there, so there was nobody to run to.
Yeah.
In the 2003.
You actually remember feeling that way, do you, in that moment?
Oh, in that moment. That
I had this, I feel that something has moved on here.
Well, I'll tell you how I know it when I look back on it. It's had this tremendous high of hearing people chant that spontaneously. But then immediately afterwards, this sense of complete bathos, like Tyrone won the All-Ireland title, but then suddenly, you know, okay, now there's just going back and thanking the physios and so on, all those things that winning captains do.
Yeah.
And realising that that was it, and they had it was a great thing that they had done what they intended to do to honour him, but that was it, like that, you know, Tyrone football would remember him, but it would also move on.
Yeah, the very first line of the book, Cormac was always there. It's one of the shortest lines of the book, but it's one of the most powerful ones. What was the earliest memory for you of having Cormac as a little brother?
I actually can't remember. I remember my youngest brother, Fergus, being born when I was about 3.5. It was a year and a half. Cormac was a year and a half younger than me. So anything I remember, he was there. Early, like, it's almost invariably wrapped up with sport.
Although you used to claim you remember him being born.
No, I didn't say that, but I'll tell you what he remember. He claimed. Now, bear in mind, he was born in February 1980. He maintained to the very end, although he started off seriously, and I think he was just winding me up in latter years, that he remembered the 1982 World Cup.
Oh, that was...
Now, this went on, this was a theatrical argument that went for years. I said, how could you possibly remember that? You'd have been 2 years and 4 or 5 months. How could you know? He just says, well, I remember these guys that were on the pitch, and I remember it was really important. And I said, but how would you distinguish that from any other match? He says, I just know. And I think it was just winding me up. But it's one of those set pieces that between brothers or something, you know, your constant banter, you know.
When you walked into studio, I've obviously seen photos of you and I've seen photos of you and Cormac together. And yeah, there's a resemblance, but it was only when I met you in person that I got the reason behind the two of you being routinely confused and mixed up by other people. Started very early, but and it's even happened a couple of times since Cormac died, where people have called you Cormac, and now you just say, don't worry about it, because people, as soon as they realise the mistake they've made, are probably horrified, and you just say now, I'm honoured.
Yeah.
That's your response now, like 13 years out from Cormac's death. When it happened as a child and in your teens, and when Cormac really started to kind of move into the realms of superstardom, how did you feel about it then?
Well, I didn't see the physical resemblance myself back then. I look back and I see it more, you know, and, you know, we'd always been together and everything. We were, you know, you didn't get one part. We were a two-part package and that was it. But then what happens is in about 1996, he starts to suddenly accelerate. I had always seen him on a par, but then he was younger in terms of the teams we were taking part. We were in the same school football teams, basketball teams, club football teams, and even went on to university and so on. But that there came that juncture where I didn't make it as a county player and he did. And then he didn't just make it. He became a captain and a winning captain. And, you know, like any, I imagine like any competitive player who has a brother or sister taking part at that level, there was, you know, I was very happy for him. But there's also that sort of I felt, particularly because it was the older brother, felt sort of like put down by it. It wasn't, you know, people might have mistaken maybe if I ever expressed my annoyance about anything ever, they might have thought it might have been envy or something. It's not straightforward. It's a sort of like...
like a bit of begrudgery.
Just give me, yeah. But like, you know, it's sort of like just remember him here more, like, you know.
Well, there's a couple of just really interesting aspects of that that you have in the book. Very early in the book, you include a diagram of an early school report card. Well, it's actually you've put it together. You put the two report cards together in your diary and your results are alongside Cormac's, and he's bettered your result in 11 of the 12 subjects. And you write in the book, revisiting it now, it appears I was looking over my shoulder. We weren't taking the same exams, but I saw the new kid in town outscoring me in most subjects. He would be my yardstick and I his. And then later in the book, you describe the time of Cormac. He's really starting to find his feet as a Tyrone senior footballer. And there's mixed emotions for you. It's been said of GAA County stars, sure, his brother at home is twice as good. People didn't say that about me. While he soared on the sports field, I plateaued and I became even more Cormac's brother. In those years of prematurity, of self-discovery, I winced to see my identity diluted. Now, I have a little brother. When I read that, I remember being in sixth class in school and not making the school football team. And my brother, who's 15 months younger than me, getting into the starting 15. And I was absolutely appalled. I was delighted he was in the team, but I was embarrassed. I was kind of horrified and I was a bit bitter as well.
Are you okay now?
I'm just about getting over it. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it for so long until I read that paragraph. Yeah, so like what was it like for you?
Well, it was like that, you know, but it happened like so high for him. You know, it's fascinating to hear you identify with that. I'm really sort of wary about writing something like that, thinking, God, people around home are going to say, oh, they're like a self-indulgent stuff. But no, I'm trying to tap into that just like you've said there, it's that sense of being a brother and brothers whose very participation is shaped by the competitive instinct that they learned on that lawn at home. Mm-hmm. And when they go their separate ways, when the fork in the road happens, when they diverge, and how you deal with it. Because, you know, with it being such a parochial country and such a parochial organisation as the GAA is, you know, you're defined by that identity. And I don't know. I thought that I could give a particular insight there, but what happened was that, you know, I'd written about it at the time, and in the case of those exam results, he said, like, you know, we were playing darts when that happened.
When the postman arrived.
It was a dull January morning, but for some reason I wrote it down in my diary, and it's when I now revisit that 25 plus years later, I now realise, you know, even though he was the younger brother, he was setting the bar for me. So like, even when I was playing in Ulster basketball final with the school when I was 13, 14, and on the way home from the match, like, I was like, what did you think? Were you proud of me today? You know, like, such a naive, stupid question.
Not a question that you would normally associate with a big brother asking of a little brother.
No, I know, but it's sort of the way he said, he was the man setting the standard for me. And you look back on that now and you realise it, but you didn't, it took many years of perspective to realise it.
You quote from his diary throughout the book, but in relation to this part of it, you quote from something that he wrote when you guys were in Queens and you're both trying to get onto the university team, and he seemed so disappointed that you weren't getting on. There's an excerpt from his diary after one team is picked, or after a game, you were on the bench, didn't get on to play any minutes of the game. And then in the next game, you don't make the match day squad. And you can tell from the tone of what he's written in his diary how desperately disappointed he is for you. And you, there's a sense that you always understood now, you understand now, maybe not when Cormac was alive, but that he thought so much more of you as an athlete than you did of yourself.
Well, when you're taking part, you have to believe in yourself to some extent. Otherwise, you're doomed to fail. But he believed in me more than other people, maybe at times. And, you know, he would always said, you know, you're not a quitter. And, you know, just it always been pulling me along, you know, even when things were down. And, you know, let's say, like, even if I was playing, like, even if on the rare occasion when I'd have playing at a team with a high level and he wasn't playing, he'd have been the one after the match who'd have said, you were through for a goal that time. I never passed to you. And I had just become so accustomed to not getting that killer pass because I wasn't that killer forward that I just said, that's life. But he would have been the one saying, they didn't give that to you, and have this sort of sense of grievance about it. So, you know, that was him. You know, and it's when you read extracts from his diary like that, from that age, and he was only 17 when he's writing that, you realise, like, now, and it's so emotional to read that and say, he was so mature, he was so profound, he cared so much, he was so considerate. And, you know, like, you know, he was so earnest, and he really did want the best for me. And he always tried to do his best for everybody. And sometimes you wonder, did he try to do too much for everybody? Mm. Were we considered enough of him?
Yeah, and it's something that comes up in and around the chapters around his death, where you're searching for answers. You're looking for the mystery to be solved as to how can someone so healthy and so fit pass away so suddenly. You include so many examples about how different your approach was into things, yourself and Cormac. And in doing that, you give us the insight into the almost obsessive way that he tackled his game. And he was always looking for that tiny little edge that might lead just to the smallest incremental improvement. And you include the charts that he had put together himself on his performances in games, where he'll mark himself out of 10 across every facet of the game, from the mental side to how his head was, to how he was an attacking player. Did he defend well enough? Did he commit to the team well enough? And there's also the reference to the fact that prior to Tyrone winning that All-Ireland in 2003, that he photoshopped a picture of Sam Maguire into the hands of Peter Canavan. Like, this was a guy that was just so obviously driven. Mm-hmm. What was it like to live with someone like that?
Well, I have to give credit to my brother Fergus. He did the photoshopping, so shout out to Fergus. But, you know, like that thing of documenting our performance, that goes way back to, like, I traced it back to the 1980 World Cup when we were filling in wall charts. And then after that was done, we said, we'll record our own details, our own matches. But then as he comes into his late teens, he starts marking his performances. I knew he was doing it, but he wouldn't really have discussed that with me. You know, and, you know, he would never have asked me my opinion. He had to be honest with himself. That's whole part of the whole sort of, you're making yourself that part of the psychology, that the player themselves becomes a psychologist.
Was he being 100% honest with himself, though?
Oh, absolutely.
When you go through the charts, Donald, there's no nines, there are no tens.
This is the odd nine.
Was he being self-deprecating, or did he genuinely believe that he never performed one aspect of the game to the absolute best of his ability?
Well, there's a time where he seems to be marking, initially, it seems when he's 18, he's marking himself out of 5 stars. But he only ever gives himself 4 stars, and only maybe 4 times in the year. So I'm sort of wondering, is he marking himself out of 4, or is he marking out of 5? And the irony was, the same fella, when he was at school, used to complain about art subjects and university, say, but you can never get more than 70-something in the arts. That's not fair, you know. But there he was in himself, when he could do it. He wouldn't award himself the full mark. But, you know, he gave himself the odd 9. But, like, the highest, like, let's say he marked the 5 components of play that he was marking himself out of in his latter years: head, body, legs, offence and defence. The most he ever gave himself was 43.5 out of 50. You know, you could have gone higher. After they'd won the All-Ireland title, 2003, the final, he could have just jacked it in and said, that's that, mission accomplished. But no, he gave himself 6 out of 10 for offensive play. As a full-back, marking Stephen McDonald, the player of the year and scorer of 5.23, as if to say, well, I must do more attacking as a full-back. Mm. You know, He was quite intense, and, you know, some people would have said to me that I was intense, and people would have been less forgiving of it from me, with, you know, you need to relax. But the example that I had beside me was of somebody who was very meticulous and intense in his preparation. And there are times, you know, even during that glory year of 2003, whenever everything on the surface was going brilliantly, but he did feel the pressure. He never took his place in the team for granted. One man who never doubted his place in the team was Mickey Hart. But Cormac himself, during the course of injuries and then an unfortunate suspension, even in that year, like, he was very you know, very worried at times. You know, this Tyrone team's getting really good. Players are coming to this, you know, everybody's playing well. Sean Kavanagh suddenly come into the midfield and he's this...
And did he speak openly about these types of thoughts and feelings to the family and to you?
You would have heard it about it at home, but, you know, it was partly the worries of a string of bad luck, because he had a really unfortunate suspension, but then he also had a series of injuries. It started off with knee injuries, but then he had a couple of head injuries, and the sheer frustration of not getting any impetus. And he thought that that was our momentum, and he thought that was going to be the year. And if it was going to be the year, he had to be there. And, you know, he just was really worried that he mightn't be there and part of it, because he had been the captain right through from minor under 21s, and this was absolutely a sense of mission. And but when you look back on it now and you see, you know, all the worries that he had that year and combine it with injuries and all, you just, I can't help but wonder, you know, how these things play off each other. What sense do we make them now? Do we, can you overanalyze it? Did it have some part in his ultimate demise? There's no way of, like, you know, putting that...
There's no answers.
Well, it's not that there are no answers. I mean, we have a medical explanation of long QT.
But in terms of the emotional and the mental,
yeah, the emotional,
side of things,
like, I mean,
taking its toll on him.
There are some extraordinary diary things that I wrote.
I wanted to ask you about the diary excerpts from the Compromise Rules trip to Australia, where it's just heartbreaking. Like, everybody has suffered from homesickness or loneliness, insecurities, anxiety at some stage in their lives. But when you read how unhappy he was in Australia and how he was constantly worried that he was seen as a little bit of an outsider within the group, that the Armagh boys weren't talking to him, that there were cliques forming in and around the panel that he wasn't involved in, and he would ring in home in tears, he'd ring his girlfriend and future fiance in tears, he'd ring your mother in tears, and he seemed to be getting more and more anxious about the pressure of juggling all the various parts of his life, from his game to his education to family life to his music, that I wonder, did he ever voice them? Because he just seemed like, me looking at him at the time, I was in my early 20s, I was in college, just this uber confident superstar elite athlete. But when you get inside his head, as you do so brilliantly with these diary entries, he looks like he comes across as a guy who's so much insecurity and worries.
Well, the first thing I'd want to say there is, you know, he was an ordinary man. He was a very conscientious person. So we're not talking about anybody here who would have said, or of whom you could say, that he had any sort of mental, you know, illness or anything like that. It's not that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. He was just such a conscientious fella that he felt that he always wanted to do the best for everybody, but was obviously feeling really stretched. And, you know, after winning the All-Ireland 2003 and that Australia trip, you would think, from the outside looking in, there's a guy who's having the time of his life. And you'd see pictures of him on the surfboard in Australia in the back of the paper, and you'd say, well, you know, isn't that the life?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the dairy, and I remember my own memories. He did articulate it on the phone, and one time I told him to wise up and say, look, when he rang back from Australia, you've got everything, don't worry, like, this, you know, this sort of... But I suppose that shows you took for granted, because he had always dealt with everything so well, you always took it for granted that, you know, he was just this impermeable rock. And, you talk about the dairy, like, this part of me feels bad, you know, putting that out there and sort of saying, you know, he didn't write that for public consumption, but on the other hand, you know, I remember that, how he felt at times. I didn't realise how much he felt it. I didn't realise maybe it was so recurrent over a period of weeks. And ultimately, it may not mean anything in the context of his death, even though it happened a few months later. I'm not saying it does have any relevance, but, you know, you just... I came to realise that I couldn't do justice to the profundity of his writing and his thinking by my own words there. It really had to, if I was going to talk about it, it had to come from his own words. And I came to the conclusion I was going to put it on the understanding that, although it shows a very different side of him and a personal, a human side of him, that people did, a frail even side of him that people didn't expect, that it doesn't reflect badly on him and his, you know, and his motives and his intentions and the way he conducted himself.
It's a good thing, though, isn't it? Because there are so many people out there maybe listening to this interview right now that were in Cormac's shoes. And they're in those shoes right now in terms of trying to juggle all the pressures of college life. If there might be intercounty hurlers or footballers or camogie players, and they just sometimes can't see the wood for the trees. And while they're trying to put this outward persona of being extremely confident and full of self-belief, their doubts and their anxieties are justified. And if someone like Cormac McAnallan suffered from those, well, it shows how perfectly normal it is.
It does, yeah. And, you know, like, he was... you know, there he was, like, you know, there was, as you say, like, Tyrone duties, club duties, Ireland duties, being a boyfriend and fiancé, a school teacher with different school teams and as well as classes, and being a family member. And, you know, you wonder about pressure they might have put on him, and, you know, you expected too much of him. I must stress, you know, it's not my intention to say, you know, that he alone suffered those sort of pressures. Like, it's like that for many players, particularly after they win their landlord, they're at the pick of their game. But, you know, it is, I had access to a particular set of records and memories that, you know, reveal quite, you know, how things don't ease up. And, you know, you just, it's just, it's the way he died, when he died, and now we have those, you can see that, and you just think, you know, God, it's, just wish you could have done things differently then, you know. And, you know, we would always have pushed him to try and facilitate people. If people asked him, we always try to facilitate. There was no such thing as, oh, such and such a journalist or is ringing, or somebody wants a jersey sent. We weren't deflecting them. We were, come on through, we were, we'll get that done for you. And I would have been the absolute champion of, you know, doing things for the right reason, the voluntary spirit. But you look back on it now and think, well, you know, maybe it should have been a bit more look after number one. It mightn't have changed a darn thing. But you still sort of have that, you know, it does have that, you do have that slight pang of guilt or whatever word you want to use for it.
The chapter on Cormac's death is obviously one of the key parts of the book, and I won't go into it in detail now, but at his funeral you described him as not a saint but a good solid lad, and you say that it's something you regretted saying for a while but you don't anymore. And I just wonder, when did that change? How has writing this book changed the way that you think about Cormac, about your relationship with him, and maybe by extension about how you view your own life and that of your family, and you're married with children now yourself? Like, what sort of therapeutic experience has this book and the writing of it been for you?
Well, I intended to write it. Sorry, I once upon a time, way back over a decade ago, I said it would be a good thing to write a book about Cormac. But, you know, life was just so hectic then. There were so many things happening. And I said, you know, sometime. But, I mean, the medical issues arising, you know, went on for, we didn't even, there was no issue of an inquest being offered until 2.5 years later, autumn 2006. So that gives you an idea of how much was going on, and so many other memorials other people are putting forward. But another thing within all that was, I didn't want, like, you know, there was so much stuff about Cormac, and maybe some people think a story is already told, but I knew there were many other layers to the story beyond the many things that were written and said about him in public. And, but I didn't want, like, it was not my intention to in any way exploit Cormac's memory, if you want, if you, to be, you put it in its worst perspective. You know, I wanted, you know, I wanted to do, plough my own furrow in life and do my own thing, and then in due course do a book on Cormac. I didn't anticipate that would take 13 years. But then I didn't anticipate that life would go the way it did. And, you know, you go back to work and you try and make a career, and, you know, you get married and have children. I have three lovely girls now and wife. And, you know, but, you know, I wouldn't have anticipated that Cormac would still mean so much after that time. But he clearly does. Maybe it's just that sort of eternal optimism of youth. He dying at the very peak. He didn't suffer the indignity of, you know, losing his powers on the field of play and, you know, having to be substituted and, you know, people questioning whether ever he was that good in the first place.
So much has changed in the 13 years since he died. I mean, we see defibrillators everywhere now. We see screening programs in place. And from the point of view of his memory, we have the Cormac and Allan Cup, which is given to the winners of the International Rules Series. There's a GA club in Sydney that is named after him. So there's so many ways that his memory has been honoured over the years. In its totality, how would you describe Cormac's legacy?
Of his life, precious memories, in terms of the medical aspect, saved lives, because people have been saved, players have been saved, and people have been saved by defibrillators that were provided by the Cormac Trust, but also on a wider national level. I mean, there's a higher per capita distribution of defibrillators in Ireland now than most countries in the world. And before he died, there was very little awareness of what they even were. So there's that, and screening as well has saved lives. But, and then, in terms of his legacy, well, when you go revisit it and you put it, and for me, you asked me a question a minute ago about this, but there was an element of personal rediscovery in the book, you know, going back and realising how a brother can shape you and you shape him, and how it was trying to get into explain what made him so special in terms of achieve, like many other people achieve, but what made him so special in people's memory, why that is. And hopefully when I've actually maybe even demythologized it, saves him a time, just told the real man as he was, the facts, you know. But that still will, so, you know, the other aspect of his legacy, that he inspires people and youngsters in the future.
When we knew you were coming in, and when the lad said that we were going to be discussing the book, I was trying to figure out, how do you bring a chat like this to an end? What's the best way to finish it? And it was fairly obvious, having gone through the last couple of chapters of the book, in the epilogue, there's one of the standout pages. It includes a poem that Cormac wrote, 1994? So he's about 13?
Yeah, yeah.
13 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the future. And I was wondering, would you read for us?
My first poetry recital. What on earth will the future be like? A question plaguing writers and thinkers alike. It cannot be found, but everyone tries. When it happens, it no longer applies. The invisible, inaudible fourth dimension. The will of God, time's extension. If only we could get a sample, put it up as a prime example. If only we could catch a glimpse of the future.
Donald, thanks so much for coming in. It's just an amazing read. I'd encourage anyone who has had any, that Cormac had any impact on other lives, anyone who just likes GAA, just to have a read of it. And the best luck with the launch.
Thanks, my lady.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.